Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Welcome back to the Tailgate Podcast and another incredible weekend of college lacrosse. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Nick Osello. Nick, we have to start in the most obvious location. Congratulations to the Notre Dame club team on winning a championship that I didn't even know existed.
Listen, that tweet came across my desk. My assistant sent me that tweet, and I never want to hear that Notre Dame doesn't have any lacrosse hardware, because now I not only have a picture, I have Twitter threads, the Notre Dame main lacrosse account was getting after it, and just like every other person from every other college says, it's just different on that campus. So, you know, I heard that there were 20,000, which is bigger than the student body population, people on campus to welcome them back, and it was a party that is probably still going on into the wee sunset and next day morning hours. So credit to the fellas.
You are correct. We are recording this on Monday morning after, like I said, what was another incredible weekend of college lacrosse. We needed Sunday to recover. So Nick, where do we start?
Good question. And I feel like there needs to be more hype going into rivalry week. I saw like some individual matchups. I saw some hype around a couple different games. I saw, oh, this means a lot for the Big Ten, which is where we'll start. But just the entire rivalry week, I feel, needed to be pushed and branded a little bit more. We're starting with Hopkins, Maryland. That doesn't mean you're better than Army-Navy. That doesn't mean you're better than Penn State, Rutgers, and certainly not Michigan-Ohio State. So need everybody to start pushing the ball in the right direction, because what a weekend it was. And we will start with Hopkins, Maryland, which most people would say is at least a top 50 rivalry in the sport of lacrosse. And it sealed what I think is one of the stories of the season, which is a huge swing from a Hopkins team that was disappointing a year ago. And an impressive turnaround, credit to Milliman. They played a game, that ultimately came down, and what you probably saw on social media, a one-on-one between two of the most talented players, not only on the field, but in the entire country. I really want to keep pronouncing his name wrong, but I feel like I can't when I'm talking about a goal this good. But Melendez and Makar, an ex goes left, goes right, comes back to the left side of the field, but keeps the stick in his right. And as he dives, he throws a backhand shot that goes in and ultimately was the game-winning goal. And I love rivalry games because, especially in close rivalry games, you can often tab it to one crucial moment where someone stepped up. That was him. And it was good to see a game that was chippy all game long. People bumping shoulders on the way to huddles. A lot of smack talk, a lot of "your mother" was being said, and Hopkins ultimately has a share of the Big Ten title. And what a game, what an atmosphere, what a rivalry, what a storyline. There was no other place to start. And again, I can't credit Milliman enough for this awesome turnaround that Hopkins has had. And it's good to see chippiness. I love chippiness. It makes it better for the fans. It makes it better for everybody. And credit to Hopkins. I hate to say it, but credit to Hopkins.
Yeah, you're going to give credit to a number of teams that you don't like giving credit to this weekend. But that being said, I think you started in the right place, because one thing that stood out to me from this game was when they interviewed Pete Milliman post-game and the lower third labeled his Hopkins record at 21-22, despite the fact that he's 11-4 this season. You know, it's easy to isolate how disappointing last year's regular season Hopkins Maryland game was, and they talked about it in the post game. But for me, it's not just that. It's the fact that, you know, the 2021 and 2022 seasons were really difficult for this team and this program. And, you know, I feel like I've reported a lot on it throughout Pete's getting hired and kind of the circumstances surrounding the way in which they got off the ground, you know, not having a fall and everything that went along with that. Obviously playing a Big Ten only schedule in their first year and then seeing incremental gains in year two, but certainly not that type of hockey stick that you would have liked to have seen in terms of increased quality. But over the course of this year, it's funny because you and I have spoken a lot about performance in close games being unsustainable and the reversion of the mean coming. And this year, you know, the conversation has largely been about Penn, you know, because they were, what, 6-3 in one goal games last year. And I think at one point this year they were 2-4. And that's just illustrates the whole fact that, you know, if you rely on winning one goal games, you're not going to be, you know, incredibly, it's not going to be a long-term plan that's going to get you at 70-80% wins. But at the same time, Hopkins has been so good in the fourth quarter. And whether that's a function of, you know, the strength and conditioning approach and fatigue, or whether it's a strong function of the, you know, mental and emotional composure that's required in order to be successful down the stretch, you know, I'm not saying it doesn't matter. It definitely matters, and it could, and it probably is both. But the point is that, you know, basically since the North Carolina game, this team has outscored their opponents in every single fourth quarter. And, you know, I kind of set the table with all of that to say, in my opinion, Hopkins didn't win this game on Saturday night. They won this game throughout late February, March, and into mid-April. And the reason is because, you know, there were 7,000 fans in a night game at their rival, and they had this baggage of the way in which last season's regular season game unfolded carrying with them. It would have been very easy to understand how they wouldn't have been able to put in a good performance. The moment would have been a little bit too big for them. But there was no point in this game where I felt like the outcome was going to be anything other than the one goal game that it ended up being. And, you know, I think to isolate that last moment is certainly appropriate, but the number of moments that led up to it, and specifically the thing that for me separated the outcome of the game, was how good Johns Hopkins was picking up ground balls and getting out of traffic in their defensive end in the fourth quarter. You know, Maryland had one opportunity in the last 30 seconds of the game to tie it and potentially send it to overtime. And I didn't know whether they were going to be able to convert on that. You know, their offense had been playing moderately well. They had, you know, committed turnovers, made mistakes, gone offsides, that sort of thing in the fourth quarter. But from the standpoint of being able to get a look and can a shot, they were still doing that with some level of proficiency. What I felt like Hopkins was doing is, once the ball was on the ground, it was coming up in a blue jersey every single time. And it wasn't just about the fact that they were coming up with a ground ball. It was that they were running out of coffin corners. They were just like kind of, you know, goosing ground balls to each other, throwing the ball on the ground so that their teammate could come up with it, as opposed to, like, you know, trying to throw a 4-yard pass that was going to go out of bounds, whatever the case may be. So, yeah, it was a pretty incredible performance from the Blue Jays, and, you know, certainly one that I think from my standpoint, like, I don't know that this team can win a championship, but based on what I've seen over the last 2 months, there is no question they can win two games in the NCAA tournament and go to the Final Four.
Well, and it's another good stark contrast between, you know, not isolating that moment. I think you're absolutely right to call out, you know, kind of this game being won in February. But one of the talking points that we had very early on in the season was, who is the personnel? Like, I remember a close game, and I can't recall which one, but we were talking about, in clutch moments, do you really need to be shuffling through personnel? Is this going to bode well for the entire season? And honestly, it ended up did boding well for the entire season, because I feel like, to your point, of course Melendez is the guy that everybody tabs, but a lot of the other players are showing, I don't know if it's a sense of maturity, a sense of bought-ittedness. I think there's a lot of overused tropes that end up, oh, well, this roster is just bought in. I think that's kind of a overused and stupid term, but it seems like the payoff from the roster kind of shuffling going on early in the season has benefited a lot of players with real game experience, which could represent itself in a number of ways. This most recent example being ground balls. And anytime you watch the difference between college and pro, and particularly the NLL, I would argue, is getting a ground ball doesn't mean that you get possession. Because a ground ball, when there's pressure, is one of the most difficult ways to escape. And that is really, really hard to replicate in practice. It's extremely difficult to replicate location, situations, one player pressing, two player pressings, where the guys are going to be. Because in those ground ball situations, it's generally speaking a complete scrum. The offensive players don't know if they're going to have to sub off. They don't know if they're going to have to be open for a pass. So I'll say that the talking point that we were semi-concerned about, or saying that it was going to pay off, ultimately did pay off. And in this instance, it was ground balls and their particular ability to maintain possession out of that.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that to your point about variety and options and versatility in personnel, it's not just a function of the mixing and matching. It's also a function of injuries. And that's a combination of guys returning from injury. So Casey McDermott had two assists in this game. You know, he was a midfielder who missed the first month of the season or more recovering from an off-season foot injury. And, you know, there were times in this game when he got runs and I was just like, is this the right moment for that? And he rewarded his offensive coaching staff's faith in him. I thought that that was, you know, incredibly significant. Coming into the season, Scott Smith putting up a five ground ball, three cause turnover performance at the defensive end. That wasn't going to be a surprise. Alex Mazzone putting up an eight ground ball, two cause turnover performance. Not going to be a surprise, at least, you know, but to that extent, right? And then Carson Brown, you know, they have had a little bit of a rotating door at the long stick midi position. You know, Mazzone playing up top and playing down low. Patrick Dean, Dean's being hurt at times throughout the season. And then Carson Brown, a freshman, you know, has been incredibly consistent. And he comes in with a three ground ball, two cause turnover performance himself. So I think that, you know, for me, the point is, this team is better in terms of, you know, the talent on the roster, but it's also better in terms of the individual belief, both in the staff on the individual guys, as well as the players within their own ability. And so, you know, I think that that to win the game is something, right? It's significant. This is obviously a rivalry, as you discussed. It might be a top 50 rivalry in the sport of lacrosse. I don't know. I'd have to go take another look at it. But that being said, even if they had lost by a goal, the performance was so much more impressive than the same performance a year ago. And I think that's the starting place to focus on. There's no question the win is valuable from an NCAA tournament standpoint. The win is valuable from a Big Ten tournament standpoint. It's valuable from an alumni bragging rights standpoint. All those things are a function of the binary result. But in terms of how the team feels about itself, how the team charts its progress going forward, they could have lost this goal by a goal, and they still would have been able to point to, you know, an incredible amount of year-over-year progress. So the fact that they won, you know, is very much just icing on top of the cake. And I know that you don't like shouting out short stick D middies, but I just have to say, Brett Martin and Hunter Jaronski for me were incredible. So
damn it,
those
Terry.
Two guys were a tremendous reason that Johns Hopkins came out on top. And even more than that, I know that you don't like shouting out faceoff guys. And Tyler Dunn, you know, the faceoff rotation has been a strength for Johns Hopkins. You know, early in the season, it was Dunn and Logan Callahan. Matt Naruski came back after the first couple games of the season. You know, they've definitely had him on a pitch count. You know, he took, I believe, the first four faceoffs against Luke Weirman. I don't believe he won. And then from that point forward, Tyler Dunn came in and battled. He came out less than 50% on the day. I'm looking at it now. He came out at 14-23 on the day. And, you know, against one of the best faceoff guys in the country, getting over 50%, much less over 60%, is pretty incredible. So shout out to Tyler Dunn for continuing to feed his team offensive chances.
And final point is, when Hopkins kind of plays like the woe is me, everybody likes to dogpile, the world is against us, I would probably become not a Hopkins fan and not a sympathizer, but I would become a general Hopkins supporter if they just took all of the instruments that band plays, threw him into a fire, and I never had to hear that song again. You know, and this is coming from a Notre Dame guy. Boy, do they make their program hateable with just one little action. It's like the doctors hate him. Just this one trick made everybody think Hopkins was kind of an okay program, and it's getting rid of that song. Do you like that song?
No. No.
Good. All right. Finally, so we can put the nail in that coffin and we can move on to the second game that we're going to talk about, which might not have been the best game of the weekend, but certainly one that is one of the crowd favorites and one of my favorite every year, Army-Navy. And just one of the coolest game in all of sports. I don't care what sport it is. Anytime Army-Navy plays, it's worthwhile to talk about. And I'm too much of a patriot to not talk about it, even though realistically Army just came out and took care of business. And the weird one, nothing really was surprising. Nothing really, you know, I feel like people expected Army to win this game. Yes, Navy came out slow and Army started hot, but it's kind of another little microcosm of, you know, Army coming out and revamping. I was surprised to see that they hadn't won since 2019 because they've had such a good year. I figured that they were carrying momentum into it. So another little representation of a program that's, you know, certainly not turning around, but playing up to their potential. And again, the story of the game generally was Army's preparedness and Navy's slow start. And by halftime, it was already 9-2. Worth talking about, there was some inclement weather that moved the game up, I believe, 5 or 6 hours, which should, generally speaking,
play into the home team. Yeah, so it was originally scheduled for 7, and they started it at 1.
Yeah. So you would think that that would be somewhat of an advantage for the home team, you know, understanding the area, knowing everything, but no. You know, I'll give a little shout out to Xavier Arline, even though in the loss he had one of the cooler goals, and it's cool to see the moniker of football player guy playing lacrosse exhibit ridiculously high level stick skills, so credit to him. And as far as Army Navy goes, how many Army Navy games have you been to?
I think I've been to 4, either 3 or 4. I have never been to an Army-Navy game at Army, so that's definitely on the to-do list. The last one I was at was the one in 2019, which was the last one that Army had won. It was the 100th meeting of the two teams, and it went to overtime. And Matt Manown won it in overtime, and I watched the game in the press box, but then went down to the field in order to watch like overtime and get a video of the team singing alma maters and whatever. And I was walking out of the tunnel as he scored the game-winning goal. So totally flubbed it. Didn't see like the actual goal in real time. Had to like go back and find the replay and whatever else. But yeah, the combination of, you know, elatedness and heartbreak that happens in that moment, it's just so magnified relative to your normal overtime game winners, which we have a couple more to talk about on today's podcast. And as far as this game is concerned, I think, you know, once again, you start in the right place, which is the fact that it is surprising that Navy won in 2021 and 2022. And it is notable from the standpoint of the job Joe Amplo has done. Beating Army is, you know, I don't know, is it bullet point number one on the job description of being the Navy lacrosse coach? So the fact that, you know, he had won twice while otherwise having seasons that were below the Navy standard is notable. And I think it's a two-way street. Joe Alberici has talked repeatedly about how hard this game is from an emotional management standpoint. And, you know, I can't say whether, you know, the results of the last 2 years were a function of the Black Knights being tight, but I do know that other Division I head coaches that are very familiar with these teams have said that. And that wasn't the case on Saturday, and so they deserve a tremendous amount of credit. I actually wonder if the fact that they didn't have to sit around in the hotel all day getting nervous, thinking about the stakes of this game, was to their benefit and is one of the reasons that they weren't as tight. But regardless, again, you can't win a game like this in a manner in which they won it without being the better team. And so, you know, on the heels of playing Cornell to a one-goal game at home, and then, you know, I wrote extensively about how disparate the consensus opinion of how good their team is compared to their NCAA tournament resume, kind of a lot swirling around the Black Knights, and you know, a function of a number of different things, you know. But ultimately, for me, it kind of all ties, it all ties together into the fact that you know, at both ends of the field, they know who they are. So you know, AJ Pilot, Joe Alberici has talked pretty extensively over the course of the last 10 days about how underrated he is as a number one cover defender, and I think that's right on the basis of both the analytics and in terms of the actual performances that he's put in. And then at the other end of the field, you know, Reese Burick has emerged into a incredible kind of all-around attackman, and I think that they have done a really nice job schematically and tactically in terms of freeing him up to make plays. And whether it is, you know, the manner in which and the frequency with which they try to get him switched onto a short stick, but also I think it's just so complimentary, you know, how good, how versatile the midfielders are that are attacking from up top. And you know, I'm not sure that a freshman midfielder is really in the All-America conversation, but Evan Plunkett is just so, so good. And, you know, Paul Johnson, both as a Dodger and a step-down finisher, is just so, so good. Army is good. They're legit. They're for real. And they've got one path to the NCAA tournament, and it's winning the Patriot League. And for me, that starts on this weekend with their game against Boston University, because, you know, I think that if they win and host the Patriot League tournament, the chances of them getting through the semifinals and the final increase significantly relative to if they have to go on the road again, specifically to Boston, where, you know, things didn't go their way last year. There's a little bit of history.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I kind of just want to talk about Army-Navy being cool. So way to make that also useful insight. So thank you for that. We will move right along to...
Which, you know those jackets that they wear at the Army-Navy football game because it's always like 0 degrees and snowing outside? Yeah. Which do you prefer, the Army gray jackets or the Navy kind of very, very dark Navy black? I don't know whether they're Navy or black jackets.
Those gray ones, I just feel, are so cool. Like, of all the pieces of merch, I'm always torn between, like, yeah, something really cool and modern, or just, like, the throwback, it just says, like, Army in black letters on a gray coat that just looks issue. It just, oh, so sick. And then you just have a bunch of guys way tougher than me standing around, you know, the sideline heater, and I'm like, you guys are tougher than me. And then they always show the guy's schedule where he wakes up at like 5 and goes to bed at like 2 a.m. Yeah, great stuff. So this game was, I'm going to tab it as the what the heck of the week, as Penn State obliterates Rutgers. Let's just cut to the final score. And to secure a share of the Big Ten regular season title, Penn State beats Rutgers 14-5. What? We talked about Hopkins' turnaround, but I got to say, Penn State has to be the comeback team of the year, going 3-11 only a year ago. And it wasn't one person. It wasn't any particular reason. It was a team effort. Malone, 4-1. Winkoff, 3-1. Mercer, 2-2. And a well-balanced onslaught. And honestly, it started from the beginning. They started off with a 4-0 run. And I believe Rutgers came back and either tied it up or made it a one-goal game. But going into the fourth, it was 11-4. And past halftime, it was never really a close game. Penn State came out and executed in every facet of the game. And Rutgers came out and didn't put up the fight that they needed in a crucial game. So how did Penn State do it?
Similar to how Army did it, right? A fast start. You mentioned, obviously, it got closer as the game went along, but, you know, kind of just dominance at each end of the field. And for me, the thing I wrote about this last week that stands out is their ability to be as prolific as they were offensively without Jack Traynor or Matt Traynor having a huge role in that. And I think it's a credit to TJ Malone. When you talk about their year-over-year development, how significant it is and what causes it, you know, it is hard to focus on anything other than the guys who returned from injury and the incoming transfers and the role that they play in both those things. And TJ Malone and Jack Traynor are two of the most significant returners from injury. And then Kevin Winkoff and Chris Jordan are two of the transfers, along with an underclass transfer in Chase Mullins, excuse me, at the Faceoff X, who have been absolutely transformational. In addition to which, Jack Fracchione.
And for those, I don't even want to hear any complaints. That's a dog. That's a puppy. That's excited in the morning. If you're complaining about dog noises, and I don't even know if we're going to edit this out, but you're complaining about dog noises, here's what I encourage you to do. Go to your local shelter, go up to the receptionist and say, what's the fattest, oldest dog that you have? And then you spend the last couple months, couple years, however long you get, giving that dog that's been through so much a proper send-off to the Rainbow Bridge. Don't ever complain about dogs barking just because Terry's a great guy who takes care of his dogs. And instead, go and get one yourself and then complain. Terry, back to you.
I wasn't planning on keeping that in, but now I might.
I might have to.
Jack Fracchione made 17 saves, and he has been really consistent all year long. And Alaric Fiak is a good goalie who was up and down at times last year. I don't think he was the reason that they lost games. But I do think that Fracchione has been the reason that they have won games so far this season. And it's combined with some of the same things that we talked about with Hopkins in terms of their ability to pick up ground balls in their own defensive end, get out of dangerous situations, and convert them into offense. And one of the things that's been really interesting for me about Penn State so far this year, you'll remember we recorded the first episode of this podcast when I was driving home from the Penn State Villanova game, and they were bad at all of those things. They failed three consecutive clears in a pivotal stretch of the second half that cost them the game. And you know, at the time, they had come off of a relatively one-sided opening season opening win against Lafayette. And for me, there were still questions, like, how good is this team actually? I saw them in the fall, and I knew pretty definitively that they were going to be better just because they looked so much bigger and older, specifically offensively, than they had in 2022. But the gap between that, both in terms of the way I felt about them in mid-February and in October to now, is pretty substantial. And you know, I don't think you can measure, or I don't think that you can make a strong claim as to who is more improved between Penn State and Hopkins from last year to this year. And as far as this year, I mean, we just saw them go to overtime 10 days ago. You know, there is so little margin between these two teams. They're very similar, and they're on, from what I can tell, if not necessarily similar long-term trajectories, because I do think that Hopkins has more young talent that they're going to be able to build around, that's already proven at the collegiate level right now. Penn State, you know, they're relying a lot on a lot of older guys, and it'll be interesting to see how they continue to evolve as those guys graduate and move on. But for the time being, for the rest of this season, you know, I can only hope that these two teams meet each other again, whether it's in the Big Ten tournament or in the NCAA tournament, because you know, they're so similar, both in terms of vibe and reasons that they win, and in terms of, you know, what they put on the field, that I think it couldn't help but make for an incredible game. Also, do you know that these two teams, Rutgers and Penn State, when they play, it's called the Friendship Cup? I feel like we talked about this last year.
That's, yeah, and we talked about that being the least appropriate name for a rivalry game ever, because Pennsylvania and New Jersey, it would be 150 adjectives before I describe friendship or friendly as either one of those. So do you know the origin of that, or is it just, hey, let's,
you know, that friendship and everyone, friendly are not adjectives?
Yeah, close enough. Whatever.
Friendship is a noun, so, and friendly is an adverb.
Thanks, dork. Why don't you give me your lunch money? Anyways, what's the origin of it?
You got it.
No, I'm actually asking. I mean, you know so much. You know so much. You're such a smart guy. Why is it named the Friendship Cup?
I don't know that.
Oh, wow. It turns out you don't know everything. You know your silly little adjectives and you know your nouns and your proverbs, but you don't know the origin of the friendship cup. God, I'm going to knock your books out of your hand when you're walking down the hallway. So, we're going to move on from that, and I'm not going to let you forget that you corrected me, because now I'm going to be listening to you like a hawk, even though hawks don't really listen. Anyways,
The friendship cup is a symbol of the friendship of four friends from Sewanka High School on Long Island, who, under the leadership and of legendary lacrosse coach Bill Rich, learned what it took to play Division I lacrosse. The four went off to college, splitting two ways: one pair
oh
attending Penn State, and one heading
God.
the other heading off to Rutgers. The
I mean,
founders from Penn
that's.
State are John Meisel and Vin Tedesco. The founders from Rutgers are John Valestra and Ronald Jurcak.
Boy, was I hoping for something better than. You know when you're coaching and two players get in a fight and you make them like run around the field holding hands? Did you ever see that punishment? Or like you have to
No,
sit
but I
down
kind
and
of
hold
love it.
hands? Yeah, so there's that punishment. And I was hoping the Friendship Cup started because Penn State and Rutgers got into like a brawl. Maybe three people got hospitalized. And then they said, all right, guys, we're naming this the Friendship Cup until we can get our act together. And instead, it's just a couple of the fellas back in the day going, being from Long Island and being buddies. That's actually disappointing. We're going to have to come up with a new name for that. Maybe. Yeah, I don't even know. I'll come up with something funny later in the show.
You're
Until then, bear with me.
keep it rolling. Let's stay
Now,
in Philadelphia, or let's stay in Philadelphia.
I feel like these are two teams that we've talked about either adjacently or in the context of other stuff. And let's give a chance to talk about their games and potentially their seasons. Villanova Marquette, and honestly, this was another wild game. Where the last 2 minutes in OT was nuts. Villanova was down one, and I think they had just over a minute left. And they just kind of decided, let's go balls to the wall. Let's double. Let's press out. Let's be aggressive. They cause the turnover. They clear. And Austin Frazier had that dog in him, had that clutch gene, and not only scored the game tying goal, but scored the overtime winner. And this was one of those beautiful games that was just slugfest and a slugfest of runs. It wasn't exchanging goals. It was Villanova was up in the fourth quarter off of a four-goal run. Marquette responds with a three-goal run of their own. Big moments slash bursts of chaos throughout. And Marquette loses in the Big East, or the Marquette losses in the Big East have been three games by a combined four goals. And this is a team similar to what we were talking about with Michigan. Is they're a dangerous team. I feel like they could beat anybody on any given day, and the ball just hasn't really fallen or bounced their way. And Nova needs a little bit of help to make the playoffs. So, as it relates to this game and their seasons, I'll give you the floor however you want to take it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it starts with Marquette because their loss to Providence was probably the most damaging loss that any team has suffered so far this season, because what it meant was they had to beat one of Georgetown, Villanova, or Denver in order to qualify for the Big East tournament. And to your point about they can beat or lose to any team so far, like on any given day, they have wins over Penn State and Michigan, who are both in my top 20 this week. Penn State at number 6, Michigan at number 19 or 18. And they have losses to, I don't know if Bellarmine's their lowest ranked loss, but they lost to Bellarmine, and they have a bunch of other losses on the season. This is their second straight overtime loss. They lost to Georgetown at home last weekend and then now lose to Villanova in Philadelphia. So, clearly, their results in terms of their performances, in terms of the fact that they're taking these teams to overtime and beating, two teams who are kind of hopeful for NCAA tournament inclusion, or, one who's a lock basically in Penn State and one who's hopeful in Michigan, shows that they are really, really good and can compete with anybody. But if they don't beat Denver next weekend, they will not qualify for the Big East tournament. And so, as a result, or assuming that Marquette, or I'm sorry, Providence takes care of business against St. John's, which they may have already done this past. No, they didn't. Yeah, they still have St. John's left. And so, that result is just so incredibly damaging. And for Villanova, you know, they don't get as much credit for this win as they probably should on the basis of what I just described, right? This is a team that was coming off of an overtime loss to Georgetown. The Wildcats end their season with the Hoyas this coming weekend. And by virtue of both RPI and top 20 quality win status, this doesn't register as either, you know, an RPI boost or quality win bump for the Wildcats, and yet it's a win that they should feel very good about coming away from. And so, to your point about Austin Frazier having that dog in him, you know, I've had this conversation internally a number of times over the course of the season. You know, when it comes to voting for All-Americans and some of the other elements of position designations, like, you know, for instance, when I create the fantasy contests every week, is a player a midfielder or an attackman is an important distinction because, you know, attackmen should produce somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 30% more from a goals and assists standpoint than midfielders do, whether it's because they're on the field more or the ball's in their stick more or the role that they're asked to do, whatever the case may be. And, you know, Matt Campbell was very clearly a midfielder in 2021 based on the other guys that were a part of Villanova's offense, and he carried that over into early 22. But then by the end of the year, in my opinion, he was very clearly an attackman. He never left the field. And even though he did start the offense from positions of the field in half field sets that are typically reserved for midfielders, he was still playing attack. All that being said, you know, Villanova has a midfielder who deserves All-American consideration in Austin Frazier. And I don't know if I wrote or said it about 6 weeks ago, I got to focus on this guy a little bit more, you know, and I have in terms of, you know, following him more closely on clips and that sort of thing. And, you know, these two goals to beat Marquette are going to define Villanova's season in a lot of ways. And he deserves a lot of credit for the combination of feel for the moment, as well as obviously the composure to execute in those circumstances. So shout out to Austin Frazier for an incredible performance.
And could you just rank Marquette's season 0 to 10?
In terms of how good do they feel about it internally?
Yeah.
I mean, I would assume that my opinion of their season is higher than theirs internally. I think that they are at like a 7.5 to 8 in terms of a combination of realistic expectations and how much they should savor the heights, as well as, you know, how many of the quote unquote lows were either by like the narrowest of margins, or like, you know, as evidenced by the two overtime goals that we're talking about, you know, or, you know, relatively small sections in time. So I think it's actually a really good conversation to have in the context of Hopkins, because Andrew Stimmel is also in his third year. And one of the things that I talked about with respect to Hopkins over the last three seasons is that the stylistic approach of Dave Petromala and Pete Milliman were about as different as could possibly have been. I don't know whether that is as true for the stylistic differences between Joe Amplo and Andrew Stimmel, but I do feel pretty confidently that the state that Marquette's program was in, it was going to require a rebuild after the 2019 season, regardless of who the head coach was. And so the fact that you're now in year three and you have shown demonstrable progress, you're not 11-4 and you know, number three or whatever they are going to end up being, the Blue Jays are going to end up being in this week's media poll. But you do have those quality wins that we talked about, and you have put in incredible performances against, you know, the class of your league that you are trying to compete against, and you have your season in front of you with a game against Denver. You know, there's a lot to be pleased about. But again, you know, knowing Andrew Stimmel as I do, my assumption is that his expectations are for higher than that. So I'm going to guess that if I were to ask him, he would say something like a 5 or a 6.
That's very fair. And maybe I should have made a more clear distinction between your 0 to 10 versus the internal 0 to 10. Internal is always going to be more critical and more harsh on themselves. But Marquette, I would maybe argue, has been the most fascinating team this season, maybe with Michigan, who we'll talk about in a second, as far as Are they going to come out and lose to an inferior opponent, or are they going to come out and beat a superior opponent? Which, wow, segue alert, Michigan-Ohio State, as rivalry week continues, Michigan explodes, and it, rarely do you see a team give up 14 goals and still win by five and still have it. You know, the story of this game and the player of the game was Michael Baum, who had a program record 8 goals, and I mean, not the only program record set that day by Michigan, and to do it against Ohio State had to make it all the more sweeter, but 29 face-off wins, and I think that ties the program record, doesn't beat it, but who cares, it's face-offs. An 8-goal score and going, I mean, as close to realistic as you can get at 100% at the X is a good sign, but even with that, it was kind of like a tale of two halves, and of all the quarters, we talked about Johns Hopkins exploding. I think it was in the third quarter last week. It was Michigan's third quarter this week. At half, it was 7-7. And in the third quarter, Michigan not only went on an 8-goal run, but I think outscored Ohio State 10-2 in the entire time. How you score 10 goals in a quarter is a little bit beyond me. So, close game. Halftime adjustments, Michigan comes out and just dominates. And from there, yeah, Ohio State showed a little life at the end, but ultimately that third quarter decided the fate of the entire game. And again, you know, Terry, kind of balls in your court as far as do you want to focus more on this game or in the context of a Michigan team that, you know, outside of getting absolutely shellacked by Notre Dame, has seemingly been a team that you don't want to run into because you don't really know what you're going to get. It's a trap game every single game with Michigan. Balls in your court.
Yeah, so for this game in particular, I thought that the script was pretty clear. Michigan was going to be able to win faceoffs at an exceptional rate. Ohio State has really struggled at the faceoff X since Drew Blanchard's injury, and they, for lack of a better way of putting it, like, just don't have very many options. So, you know, they're just trying to figure it out, essentially. And the broadcast made a big deal out of Mike Boehm's staying on the field to get extra shooting in after being held scoreless at Penn State the week prior. But what was interesting to me about that game is that he still, in that game against Penn State, caused 2 turnovers and picked up 2 ground balls. And that is why I've said on this podcast previously that Mike Boehm is my favorite player. It's not just that he went to the same high school that I did and that I played with his older brother, but it's also because he has the ability and a willingness to impact the game in so many different ways, even if he's not scoring or assisting. And on top of that, he has, over the course, I mean, he's a junior, and over the course of his career has, you know, produced either in biggest moments or in smaller moments. And so as a result, like, obviously, we celebrate big game players, and you know, that is deserved. But there's also something to be said for making sure that you show up if you're, you know, on a good team in the games that you could potentially sleep through or walk through, or the trap games that you have to avoid. You know, and his consistency in terms of doing that, in my opinion, is, you know, pretty remarkable or pretty exceptional. And you know, this was a bounce back game for sure. 8 goals on 10 shots. I felt like, you know, I can't believe he didn't have an assist because I thought that he was facilitating really well. And I think ultimately Michigan's questions over the course of the last few years have been at the defensive end, you know, and it's a combination of goalie play. And I thought that Shane Carr played pretty well in this one, while also being protected by the offense, essentially, is what it comes down to. And so, you know, when you're winning faceoffs, is not just about, making sure that you have a possession advantage. It's also about making sure that you can go on runs if your you know, team is in a position to do that, or you can be confident that you're preventing your opponent from being able to go on runs. And I thought that's exactly what we saw. So, yeah, I mean, just a good all-around performance for Michigan. We've got a rematch on the doorstep with Ohio State coming back to Ann Arbor. And, you know, we'll see what type of game plan they put together, you know, expecting a possession disadvantage. It's funny, like I said, I don't really see a whole lot of options, but I don't think that means that they don't have any options. I think that they're game plan options. You've been a part of teams that have struggled to win faceoffs, and you have figured out ways to, you know, get the possession advantage back into your favor. And I think that's, you know, kind of what they're going to have to spend the week figuring out. And, you know, I don't know what it looks like, but they are so athletic from a long pull and a short stick D midi position standpoint that, you know, if it's some really intense ride and, you know, a total hack job at the faceoff X, like, it might work. So, you know, Ohio State kind of in an AQ or bust situation, you know, certainly have had a disappointing second half of the season. But at the same time, you know, just like pretty much everybody else, their season's still in front of them.
I feel like the best way to, when you're not winning clamps, maintain possession is to get a guy like John Sexton. So I don't know if you, I don't know if John Sexton has an extra year of eligibility and he can just go play this upcoming weekend. But I'll even touch on other things. It also really helps when you know
that. Well, hold
you
on.
Can
before
push...
you move on from that.
Okay.
Before you move on from that, what was it about John Sexton's skill set that you felt like was the most, what made him good at that?
I've never seen a long pole have better a better ability to pick up the head to pick up the ball off the ground. There was a vacuum extension on his head, and anytime he got close to the ball, he was the guy that could like be out of position, but use his long pole like to go around other players and somehow scoop up the ball consistently. Other guys could do it once. He would just stand on the outside of these scrums and just to have the confidence knowing that, I don't know if he played hockey growing up, but the ball is going to be in his stick is the confidence. And even before we were with John Sexton, I feel like it's a story this year as it relates to Notre Dame has just been how hard Kavanaugh's riding. Well, don't forget that started with Matt, and it started with guys like Connor Doyle. And knowing that you could push a guy like Baptiste back, for example, and then go into a ride that's going to make it incredibly hard for them to clear the ball, not even 10 man, just pure effort and intensity in the ride, I feel like is underutilized. Like, oh, we're gonna get it to the goalie and then we're gonna have our personnel on. Well, why not start with the crazy athletic personnel, force it back, and then make the goalie and the defensive poles make mistakes? In 2015, when we played DU in the semifinals, their plan to combat that was one of the first instances of literally just take a full field shot, don't even have it anywhere close to the net, and then back it up. And I remember talking to the refs where I was like, ref, that's like, come on, that's not a shot. And I can't remember who it was, listen, it's your guess as good as mine as if that's a real shot or if it's not. But when they fling a piss missile 70 yards over the cage from their own end of the field, we have to criteria that as a shot. So between John Sexton and between knowing that you have an attack that's willing to put 100% effort and making it a nightmare every time the goalie gets the ball, that can wear on a faceoff unit, and that can wear on a clear unit. So, hey, Ohio State, that one's free. Next one will cost you. Go get a John Sexton and go get a Matt Kavanaugh and get back to me.
Keep it moving.
And a couple more things that I want to talk about. That's it, generally speaking, for in-depth game recaps. But Air Force beats Jacksonville. What the heck's going on with that? As Air Force improves to 9-5 and has kind of had that, well, they haven't, you know, they've beaten Denver and they've beaten Jacksonville. But they have a loss to Bellarmine. They have a loss to Stony Brook. What do you make of Air Force's season? Because I can't figure it out. My fighting Falcons.
So I watched, I turned this game on in time to see, I think Air Force extend their lead from 12-7 to 14-7. And then Jacksonville score four straight goals in like a 4-minute span early in the fourth quarter and think that I was going to see a Dolphin comeback. So I can't really speak to exactly why the Falcons were able to build this lead as well as I can. You know, I feel like they were able to hold on to it down the stretch. And I think that, you know, goalie play and Jason Rose was a big part of that. As far as their season in total, you know, for me, I watched the Ohio State and Denver games pretty closely, and then I had a rewatch of the Utah game, watched a little bit of the Bellarmine game and a little bit, like I said, of the Jacksonville game. And the team that I've seen so far this season is, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it, like kind of the team that you would expect to see if you've been familiar with Air Force over the last like 10 years, basically. Obviously people are familiar with Brandon Dodd, but they're very veteran, kind of all across the board, as well as, they can produce from the midfield. Tommy Hellman had, what ended up being kind of the big juice goal to start the fourth quarter. And as far as their season, I think it's a reflection of exactly what the ASUN was always going to be this year. It is so big and the travel demands are so substantial that the unpredictability that was going to come along with it was going to be the story of the league. And, you would expect that to mean that the teams were going to be really successful at home and really, bad on the road. And I think by and large, that's been the case. But obviously, this game was in Jacksonville. And so for the Falcons to take to the air, which they should be more familiar with than any other team, and head to a place that I assume there's an Air Force base in Jacksonville. I know that there's a ton of naval installations. Who knows? Maybe even something kind of in the air to benefit them. But a big win for Bill Wilson and his team. A bummer of a loss for John Galloway. They had kind of their Rock Beach setup for this one. So they were expecting to have a party, and what it really does is kind of throws the second, third, fourth place seeding in the ASUN tournament into kind of pretty heavy rotation or contention, and shuffles things up quite a bit. So we'll see how things continue to settle out. You've got Jacksonville and Air Force both at 6-2 and Bellarmine at 5-3. Utah has clinched the one seed there, 8-0 on the season, and now the pressure is on them in order to come through in the postseason. I turned that game on late. Utah beat Cleveland State, but they were down throughout a good portion of the first, I don't know, let's say 2/3 of the game, and pulled away kind of in that winning time stretch, late third quarter and into the fourth quarter. So, it's going to be an exciting tournament. These are teams with disparate styles, teams with wildly different conditions, from which their programs emanate or come or whatever. And the conference tournament, I think, is going to be really exciting.
And then the last thing I want to talk about, you ready for this one? Is this was sent to me. It's from the message boards of lacrosse. Just a reminder as everyone starts to share your rankings, the third place team in the Big Ten beat UVA and took ND to three overtimes. Don't let some in the media or Osello influence your decisions. Do what's right. The response, what or who is an Osello? The response to that. Former Notre Dame lacrosse great, podcast professional with a totally non-biased opinion. Thank you. The response to that, Johns Hopkins and Penn State have identical records. Osello was never a great at ND, a not bad, if anything. Now, can you take one guess as to who sent that to me, Terry?
Nope, no guesses.
No guesses? All right. And so now I just need your live
No
reaction.
guesses.
To Nick, not great Osello. What's your thought?
Wait, it's not Nick. Is it Nick not great or Nick not bad?
Nick, Osello was never a great at ND, a not bad, if anything. So well, it is not bad.
Right, so which is the nickname? Are you a not bad or are you a not great?
I think I was a. I prefer the never a great. So we have two
Never a
decisions:
great. Nick
Nick
never
never
great.
a great
Osello.
or Nick not bad. And honestly, what a badge of honor! So always good to see your name pop up in the cesspool that is lacrosse discussion boards. And you have the final word on what my name is, maybe for the rest of my life.
Not bad definitely has a better ring to it. Not a great is certainly more complimentary to you. Whether it's more accurate, I don't know. It kind of depends on my mood.
Depends on how I've treated
That's a
you in
good
the
note.
last 24
I think
hours.
you were closer to not a great than you were to not bad. You played pro lacrosse for what, like 9 years?
No, definitely not 9 years, 6 years, but thank you. Thank you for the overshoot.
Well, hey, if you count, you know, those two weeks of training camp in the NLL as seasons, then you're at 8 seasons.
God damn. 2 weeks of training camp and then just a season of getting healthy scratched. It wears on a kid. It wears on a kid. Well, thank you for joining me on this, and let's stop the discussion right there. Get us home, Terry.
Nick, as always, it has been a pleasure speaking to you on a Monday morning. If you like what you heard, leave a rating and review, and we will be back next week with more Tailgate Podcast.
Love you.
Love you.